This is Ozarks at Large. You may not have heard of diatoms, and without the aid of a good microscope, you haven't seen them either. But the single-celled algae are pretty important. Diatoms represent a critical part of the tree of life and, through photosynthesis, produce oxygen for the planet. Andrew Alverson, an assistant professor of biological sciences in the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, studies diatoms and recently received a nearly $440,000 grant from the National Science Foundation to learn more about the genetic composition of diatoms. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums recently spoke with Andy Alverson about the importance of the single-celled algae.
They generate about 20% of the Earth's oxygen.
I would say that's pretty important.
So one in every five breaths, thank a diatom. Thank a diatom.
Where do we find diatoms?
Everywhere there's moisture and sunlight. So you can find them in soil, actually, but they're principally found in the oceans, lakes, rivers, just about every aquatic environment.
Well, I guess if they're responsible for 20% of our breaths, it would make sense that they were abundant.
Extremely abundant, extremely abundant.
So the NSF grant I mentioned will help with genomic sequencing?
Yeah, genomic sequencing. So, you know, we're interested in understanding what generates biological diversity. In the past 5 or 10 years, it's become possible to address those kind of questions looking at the genomes of different species. So just like the Human Genome Project, we're doing that with diatoms. So we're going to sequence a bunch of genomes and interrogate those to try to figure out what has generated all of this species diversity. They're really diverse ecologically. You find them in the tropics. You find them under sea ice in the Arctic and Antarctic. So what is it that generates all this diversity?
I'm imagining they've been around longer than we have.
Much longer than we have. They've been around probably about 200 million years or so. So roughly similar to flowering plants.
This may be a silly question. When I'm thinking about a human being or a chimpanzee in the genomes, I think complication. I'm thinking single-celled algae. I mean, how many genomes can they have?
So, yeah, it's funny that the genomes of single-celled organisms can actually be, in much more ways, more complex than the genomes of things, of organisms that we consider complex. Complexity is a hard thing to define.
Right.
But they can be bigger. The genomes can be bigger. And the genomes of diatoms look to be really interesting and complex in ways that are dissimilar from humans. For example, one of the purposes of the grant is to figure out how nature has sort of cobbled together these genomes. And what I mean by that is it looks like they've acquired hundreds of genes recently from bacteria. So they last shared a common ancestor with bacteria, like on the order of billions of years ago. And so this is the movement of genes across species, across entire kingdoms on the tree of life, from bacteria to diatoms. And it's thought that these, you know, encode for really important functions. So we're going to try to dissect those patterns and figure out just how important that has been to the evolution of diatoms.
It sounds like we might not even know what we don't know about diatoms.
There are a lot of unknown unknowns.
Yeah. Job security, I suppose.
Job security, absolutely.
What do they look like? I mean, obviously, they're microscopic, so we can't see them with the naked eye. But
right.
When
you're
looking at them.
So they're really small. So they're about anywhere from 10 to 100 micrometers in diameter. So for perspective, there's 1,000 micrometers in a millimeter. So they're really small. So you can fit about 8 or 10 of them on the head of a pin.
Okay.
And what's interesting about them is that their cell wall is made out of essentially window glass. So one of the only things...
Silica?
Silica.
Okay.
Silica. So they're able to pull dissolved silica out of the water, precipitate it into this cell wall that is basically like a Petri dish. It's got one half that's a little bigger than the other, and they're beautifully ornamented. So they've got all sorts of little spines and projections and pores. They're absolutely gorgeous.
Is it, okay, hundreds of thousands of species.
Right.
What kind of training does it take to look at these very small items and say, that's this species and that's this one? Or can you even do that with your eye through the microscope?
Oh, you can do it. Yeah,
really?
This is how we identify species. Species are identified on the basis of the patterns of these projections and everything. So it does take some training.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, you know, I've been doing this my whole life.
Sure.
So my whole career, I guess. So.
Well, I mean, not to be flippant, but you can be looking and go, oh, that is A as compared to A.
Yeah. I mean, you can do that. I mean, it requires some specialized training. But yeah, it's possible, believe it or not. Yeah.
What are some of the species names? I'm imagining they're not things that roll off the tongue.
Yeah, so there's some you know, famous diatoms. One of the more famous diatoms is something called Thalassiosira pseudonana. Mm-hmm. And this is the first species to have its genome sequenced. So that's a pretty famous one. There's another one called Phaeodactylum tricornutum, which had its genome sequenced. And both of these, the genomes from those two projects, which began back in 2004, are what ultimately raised the questions that we're addressing for this project.
I know that there's all sorts of training. You've been doing this your entire career. Are there ever goosebump-producing moments in this kind of work?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the goosebump-producing moments are not the flashy ones, are not like having the genome sequence in front of you. A genome's pretty boring. I mean, imagine a Word document with a couple hundred thousand A's, C's, G's, and T's. I mean, this is not exciting. But what's exciting is when you get something under the microscope that's never been seen before. And you know that you're the first person to see this. And this is common. This is common because there's a few hundred thousand species, 10 or 12,000 have been described. So we can put something under the microscope and see things that no one's seen before. And that's where you get those goosebump moments.
Yeah. You were in Montana this spring collecting.
Yeah.
How do you collect diatoms?
It's pretty, you know, it's pretty easy. They're just floating around in the water, so you don't have to sneak up on them. So we just, you know, we're in Montana at this spring, and you just go up and throw a net out there. Now, it's a different kind of net.
I was going to say, if these are this small, the net I'm familiar with.
The mesh size is really, really small. Like 10 micrometers small. Mm-hmm. So we just throw that out there and it filters the water out, concentrates the diatom into a little tube, and we take it home with us. It's so easy that I had a 6-year-old girl helping me in Montana. So she was interested in what we were doing, and so she was helping me throw it out there and pull it in. Anyone could do it.
So you put it in a jar, take it back to the lab, and then
Put it in a jar, pack it in a cooler, check it as check luggage, bring it back. And then we look at it in the lab, and then because we're interested in getting DNA out of these, we have to go in and isolate single cells, put them into a tube, grow them up in the lab, and then that's how we get DNA out of those.
And you go to Montana because you think there's a specific diatom you need to study that's there and not here.
Right. In this case, we went to Montana because we were going after a very specific diatom, and it turns out we got it, so that's always good.
Because yeah. You don't know till you get back.
Because you don't know. It's not like collecting a plant or an animal where you can say, oh, there it is, let's grab it. We take a water sample, come back, and, you know, cross our fingers that we got it.
And are they easy to keep going?
So the most interesting ones are the most difficult to keep going. It's just kind of like Murphy's Law. You know, the things that are everywhere, you can grow them up, no problem. It's pretty labor intensive. We have to change out their water, you know, because they deplete all the nutrients. So it is labor intensive, but, you know, it's not too tough.
Okay. There is a knee-jerk response, I think, for a layperson like myself, not a scientist, to think, oh, wait, these might be some sort of canary in the coal mine. If we think climate change is doing something, or we think there's a shift in Earth, that they might give us clues that is or isn't happening? Am I overreaching?
No, not at all. So one of the main ways in which people study diatoms is to understand environmental change. So one of the great things about them is they've got this silica cell wall that preserves perfectly in sediments for thousands and thousands of years. So imagine in a lake, you know, they're alive, they're in the water column, and then they eventually sink out to the bottom into that sediment at the bottom of the lake. And this happens annually. And you can take a core from the bottom of the lake and reconstruct year by year the diatom assemblage, the species assemblage in the lake. And you can, in the Great Lakes, for example, of Michigan, where I grew up, you can see exactly when people started using phosphate-based detergents because the species composition just changes.
Wow.
It's really amazing. Yeah.
Wow. Is there any kind of nanotechnology connection here? Could these be used in any way for...
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of interest in nanotechnology because computer chips are made out of silicon, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
So the way we make computer chips, as I understand it, is we etch with lasers onto silicon. And diatoms are producing these sort of from the ground up, if you will. And they make these elaborate patterns with really high fidelity. So they replicate identical patterns from one generation to the next on the nanoscale. So there's a lot of interest in figuring out sort of how they build these patterns, how they replicate them so well from one generation to the next so that we could use them to fabricate the next generation of computer chips.
Can the genetic, the sequencing, can it be done here? I mean, can you, do you have to outsource any of it or?
Yeah, we outsource the sequencing. So we get all the DNA ready here and then we ship it out to any number of sequencing facilities all over the country. We've been sequencing at Argonne, a national lab up in Illinois.
Most of us never say the word diatom in social conversation,
right.
But it sounds like it's interesting. Obviously, the NSF knows it's valuable. Your peers, your colleagues do. Should the layperson be thinking just a little bit more about diatoms?
I think so, yeah. My PhD advisor used to say that diatoms are the most important things that no one's ever heard of. And they're important for lots of reasons, not least of which is they've accounted for a lot of the oxygen that you and I have breathed over the last few minutes. In addition, they're like little plants in that they do photosynthesis. And unlike land plants, which store starch, they take carbon dioxide, water, sunlight, make starch, diatoms make oils, omega-3 fatty acids. These accumulate in the food web, in the oceans, they eventually accumulate into fish, which we harvest for their fish oils.
Right.
So those are diatom-derived oils. Oh. So they all sorts of diatomaceous earth people use for gardening.
Sure, of course.
Probably that's what most people know. You can use them as filters for beer, for example.
I made that connection. Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, there's all sorts of applications.
Okay, so if you check it, you're in Montana collecting, mm-hmm. you check it in a cooler, it's mm-hmm. checked luggage. This has perhaps never happened,
no.
But if someone with TSA says, what's in there, I bet you don't say diatoms because that sounds crazy and it sounds like it'll shut down an airport.
It does sound a little crazy. So it's a water sample.
Okay.
It's a water sample. I've got a cooler full of water samples, and I've got a business card on there, which makes me look legitimate, and they usually let it go right through.
Anything else we should know?
Yeah, I think we've just about covered it. I mean, they're all over Arkansas. So I had an undergraduate, Kylie Jones, who just went off to medical school, and she discovered this really weird species up in Beaver Lake, for example, this species that was only known in eastern Russia and Asia. We found in Beaver Lake. So a very strange thing. So there's lots of interesting things.
So that brings up all kinds of questions, doesn't it?
All kinds of questions. How do you get from, you know, Asia all the way to Beaver Lake? So we're working on figuring that out right now. She did some sampling around the Ozarks and found them in other lakes and reservoirs. And so we're trying to figure that out right now.
It sounds like just trying to come up with the right questions to ask can be difficult sometimes because since we don't have – I mean, since no one had seen it before or maybe hadn't even looked for it. So maybe it's always been there. Maybe it's recently been there.
Yeah, we're trying to figure that out. There's ways you can figure that out by sequencing DNA. So we can probably figure out whether it was here and moved to Asia or vice versa. how recent it happened. So we're going to try to figure that one out too. So the great thing about being in Arkansas is it's relatively unexplored with respect to diatoms. So we're hoping to fill some of those gaps in the next few years.
Are there other places that are completely unexplored? I mean...
Oh, yeah. I mean, the tropics are totally unexplored, and there's a ton of diversity in the tropics. So obviously, I wouldn't mind doing some work down there as well.
You could legitimately, you know, ask for money to go to Belize or...
Oh, absolutely. You know, I spent at one point 3 weeks on a ship in the Antarctic pulling up diatom samples. I mean, there's interesting questions to be asked literally all over the world.
Science is pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah, science is pretty awesome. Yeah, it's pretty great. It's pretty great.
Andy Alverson is an assistant professor of biological sciences in the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Andy, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it was great. Thanks.
Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums talked to Andy Alverson inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio earlier this month.